So I'll tell you what I'm trying to do today. It's, yes, we're talking about Purim again. What I want to do is to fill in some gaps that not necessarily, I'll put it this way, it's not necessarily a pshat of the Purim story, and as you know, I spent a couple of weeks on that. Last week, we tried to do what I called the machshava, the ideas behind it. But what I want to do this time is to get a little bit broader to other types of ideas that when people are going to talk about Purim, these are going to be the kinds of things that are going to emerge one way or the other. So let's start with this. And just like a little bit more in terms of introduction. Sometimes you have ideas that you just have to say, okay, where do they come from? Sometimes there are ideas, if you look carefully, you'll see that there is what I would call some type of a verbal linguistic hook or connection that then creates what emerges afterwards. So one such one will be in source number one, which is citing a verse towards the end of Megillat Esther. It says as follows, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, which is translated here as the Jews undertook and irrevocably obligated themselves, Kimu v'kiblu. L'kayem is something which is established. L'kabel is to accept. Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim aleihem v'al zaram. The Jews accepted and established for themselves and their children v'al kol ha-nilvim aleihem, and anyone who was with them, v'lo ya'avar. That's why, and it will never be, and it will never move on. That means it's irrevocable. Liyoto sim et shnei ha-yamim ha-ele kichtavam u'kizmanam b'kol shana v'shana, that the Jews will do as is written in the proper days on each year. I can say the sentence in a much easier way. They accepted to make a holiday called Purim. Okay, that would be the easier way of saying it. Days, there's Purim, there's Shushan Purim, there's the way the Purim is celebrated in most places, the way it's celebrated in all cities. Apparently the rabbis also wanted to give Jerusalem some kind of place in the Purim story, even though the Purim story is a story that takes place outside of Jerusalem, and that probably deserves a little bit more of an explanation. Which means on a fundamental level, the Purim story is a story of what happens when we're isolated, or what happens not just when we're isolated, what happens when we're vulnerable. So in a certain extent, I can talk about Purim as the experience of you traveling in a place that you don't really know anybody, you really can't trust anybody, no one's got your back, and then you find yourself in an incredibly complex, life-threatening situation. So to a certain extent, that's the Purim story. Which means, what's the counter of the Purim story? The counter of the Purim story is not being in a place which isn't ours, but being in our place. Not being isolated, but having others around us. Not being alienated, but rather feeling that there is a sense of belonging. Not being vulnerable, but rather have a way of defending ourselves. Which means, in a certain sense, Purim is the anti-Zionist story, which maybe then tells us, well, there's perhaps a Zionist solution. Now, of course, non-Zionists won't like anything that I just now said, but again, the idea of the Jews being vulnerable and having, therefore, their lives threatened is unfortunately not a one-time story. Which means how many times, maybe not to this extent, and again, we take the story literally, all the Jews, no matter where they were and how spread out they were earmarked for death. Which means, in a certain sense, until we finally get to Hitler and the final solution, you don't see somebody else coming up with such an idea of simply eradicating all Jews. And is our having a state a way of protecting ourselves? Well, to a certain extent, yes. Yes. Which means as much as throughout history, somebody can kill a Jew without a second thought whatsoever. Because we were considered in whatever cultures we were living in as being inferior. But one of the messages of modern times is that Jewish blood has a price to it. And we will defend. We will defend Jews. We will defend ourselves. We will defend our people. We'll defend our people even if we're not living within the borders of this land. So I'm saying to a certain extent what's happening over here, this vulnerability, maybe that, and I think that's really the strongest word, that vulnerability is really part of this Purim story. Over here it says that we decide that after whatever happens, and really in a coincidental, in a most natural way, what happens, and we end up surviving. And the way that the survival is going to be celebrated is what I do want to focus on. But over here there is this phrase, Kimu v'kiblu, And the word over here, lekabel, to accept. Here the Jews accepted something upon themselves. So that's something which was noted by the rabbis. And let's take a look at source number two. And what I'm telling you now is very famous, but also not so simple to understand, and we're going to have to try to figure it out. And this is simply the first level of what we're trying to understand. It's a Gemara in Shabbat on Daf Peched. Over here it goes on for 2.5 pages or so, talking about Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, and receiving the Torah. V'yitatzvu b'tachtit ahar. And the Jews congregated by the bottom of the mountain. Amar Rav Avdimi, Bar Chama Bar Chasma. This Rav Avdimi said, Melamed, this comes to teach us, Shekafa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleihem et ahar kigigit. This comes to teach us that when it comes to receiving the Torah, God used, and excuse my terminology now, but I am from Brooklyn, God used mafia tactics, and he made them an offer they couldn't refuse. The language of the Gemara was, he lifted up the mountain and held it over their heads and said, well, you guys are going to accept the Torah, and what can they do? And it's even further. He held up the mountain, it says kagigit, like a barrel. We'll come to the barrel in a second. We'll see what Rashi says about this barrel. V'amar lehem, God said to them, Im atem akablima Torah mutav, if you guys accept the Torah, wonderful. V'im lav, sham tiyek v'ratchem, there is going to be your graves, your end. Now, one thing which is intriguing here is why does it say sham? Why does it say there? It should have said here. Again, this is the choice, an offer you can't refuse. You accept the Torah or you die. Amar of Acha bar Yaakov, mikan moda'a rabba li'oraita. This is a protest against the Torah. So I have to explain to you what a protest means. There's a thing which is called theft. I think we all understand theft. Theft is let's say a carjacking. You stop the car, they go over to you, they push you out of the way, they take the car, they have the keys, and they say goodbye. That's a carjacking. Okay? That's a crime. That's theft. Now, what if instead they say to you, how much do you want for the car? And you say, I'm not selling. And they say to you, okay, I'll give you $10,000. You say it's worth $15,000. And you say, well, listen, I'm not selling. I don't want to sell it for 10. I don't care. The guy hands you $10,000. Now, standing next to him, of course, is his big mafia sidekick. And the guy looks at you, and you just can't do anything. So a moda is when you now say publicly, I did not do this of my free volition. Now, the difference between the carjacking and this is the guy actually gave money. And it looks like a deal took place. But the reason the deal took place was because of what we can call undue coercion. And that's exactly what was just now said in the Gemara. If God truly picked up the mountain, and by the way, I don't care right now if you understand this figuratively or literally, if God picks up the mountain and threatens us, see, I could say this figuratively if you like. The fact that we're standing by Har Sinai, the fact that we're standing there with all the miracles and the sounds and the thunder and the heavens open up and God talks to us, that itself is as if the mountain is standing over our heads, and what choice do we have? Well, God says, I'm giving the Torah, and you say, sure, whatever you want. Why? Because what choice did we have at that point? So my point over here is, you want to take this literally? Fine, take it literally. You want to take it figuratively? That's fine as well. But either way, the observation of the Gemara is correct. Mikan moda'a rabba li'oraita. And again, we'll see in a moment what Rashi does with that phrase. This is a protest against the Torah. Amar Rava, and by the way, I keep telling you, Rava is all over the Purim story. Rava loves Purim. Amar Rava, afal pichein, nonetheless, even if we were forced to accept the Torah at Sinai, Hadr Kabluha, they returned and accepted the Torah b'mei Achashverosh, during the times of Achashverosh. Dichtiv, as it says, and he quotes the verse we started with, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, Kimu ma-shekiblu kvar. The Jews accepted what they kept what they had accepted previously. So now this whole Gemara is a little strange, but one thing I do want to note. According to this Gemara, the story of receiving the Torah, which starts near some hill by a desert, somehow ends up in Persia a long time afterwards. I'm going to skip down a little bit now to Rashi, who is all the way down in source number 4. Tachtit Tahar, what does it mean that the Jews gathered by the bottom of the mountain? Tachat Tahar Mamash. What the rabbis sensed was, it's as, I'm going to say, either as if or literally they're under the mountain. Gigit. What is a gigit? It's a barrel. What kind of barrel? So Rashi writes, Shematilin bo shechar. It's a beer barrel, which itself is quite interesting, and I'm sure it could be utilized within the Purim celebrations, that we were forced with a beer barrel, so it could be that somehow the tikkun needs to be with a beer barrel, but that's nonetheless interesting. Moda'a rabba, a protest, a great protest, and here Rashi explains, she'im yazminam ledin, if God ever invites us into a courtroom, into a legal setting, for all the things, all the parts of Torah we broke, why didn't you keep the Torah that you accepted upon themselves? Yishlam tshuva. The Jews have a response. Shekiblu ba'onis. We accepted the Torah against our will. We received the Torah against our will. I was teaching the other day, and somebody commented on this. I could not find where they got it from, but they commented that if God forced us to take the Torah, God forbid, if somebody's raped, a single girl is raped, one of the things that is in the Torah, she has the prerogative of saying that, no, I want to marry this person, and he can never divorce her against her will. It's her prerogative. You can have such a thing as date rape. You can have people that know one another, and things go too far, and so on. But once it's against her will, you can never divorce her against her will. Once you entered into a physical relationship against her will, you can never divorce her against her will. So I heard someone say, oh, that's what it means, shekablu ba'onis. So if God forced us to accept the Torah, and receive the Torah is like a marriage, so therefore God can never divorce us. God can never get rid of us because he forced us against our will. But nonetheless, what was Rashi's real point over here? If God forced us to accept the Torah, so if we ever go to court, say, excuse me, we're protesting against this. We didn't want this. You forced us to take it. And therefore, I can get the Jews out of any kind of crime that they've done because they didn't accept the Torah. This is nonetheless, they accepted it, Bimei Achashverosh, and here Rashi adds, Mei Ahavat Hanes Shanes Elohim. We accept the Torah out of love for the miracle that happened. Just again, a little bit of a sensitivity. If there it's Ba'ones, over here it should be Baratzon. If there was against our will, here the term should have been with our will. If over there perhaps we did it because we were afraid, over here it should be out of love. Which means that the phraseology of Rashi between what went wrong with the first time went right and the second time has this unevenness about it, and that to me is intriguing. But I will point out, when he says that we accepted it during the time of Achashverosh out of love, love also does something. And this is just quickly, it's the Gemara in source number 5, that when one does tshuva motivated by fear of God, it turns all of our mistakes as if they were accidents. One does tshuva out of love of God, it turns all of our mistakes as if they were merit or as if they were mitzvot. So if Rashi is saying that we accepted the Torah out of love, that may somehow be much more profound in terms of... we'll look at the words of the Gemara here. Source number 5, Amar Reish Lakish, Gedolot tshuva shezdono nasot lokish gagot. That when you do tshuva, it turns the sins, deliberate sins, into accidental sins. Shenemar, as it says, Shuvi Yisrael Hashem Lekecha, ki kashalta bavonecha. Ha'avon meizidhu. The word avon is a deliberate sin. V'kari le'michshol, but it sounds as if you tripped on it. It was indeliberate. Ini, is that the case? V'aham Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish also taught, G'dolu tshuva shezdonot nasa lo kizchuyot. That things that were done on purpose become merit. And he quotes the pasuk, V'shuv Roshami Roshov Asa Mishpatu Tztaka Aleim Yecheh. Lokashya kan me ahava kan me yira. It depends why one does tshuva. Is it out of fear of God or fear of punishment, or is it out of love of God? So there is this disconnection between the different parts of Rashi, but again, I just want to now make sense of everything we've seen till now. It starts off by saying that the Jews accepted, but what did we accept? To be very clear, what did we accept at the end of the Purim story? What's the answer? We accepted Purim. And what is Purim? Purim is time of celebration. Purim is a good holiday. Purim is a happy holiday. Purim, in a certain sense, is easy. Maybe in another sense, it's very difficult. But it's not the kind of holiday you have to be careful how you cook, what you cook, or can you drive, can you not drive, can you put a light on, not put a light on. Which means, in a certain sense, Purim is a very easygoing holiday. But nonetheless, there are some elements to it. It's especially those elements that I want to come back to now. But the first starts off, the Jews accepted the Purim holiday. Okay. Now, we may not be hearing with all of this, and I really hope to get this before I finish. Accepting the Purim holiday, is that accepting the Torah or not accepting the Torah? Because, of course, what the Gemara wants to say, oh, they accepted the Torah. But no, we're just accepting the Purim holiday. Well, maybe there is and maybe there isn't, but the verse itself is saying that they accepted the Purim holiday for the future, for future generations. And the Gemara is saying, oh, when God gave the Torah, he forced us, used mafia tactics, it was against our will, and therefore it's added in the Gemara, hold it, this is a great defense, it's a protest against it, it's a defense. You can go and say, I never sold that car willingly, that's my car, and that will stand, your protest will stand up in court. Over here, the Jews can say, we never kept the Torah. God's going to say, during, let's say, the first temple period, why did you do this? Why did you do Avodah Zarah, Gila Reot, Shvichut Tomim? Why did you do the worst possible sins? And we'll say, well, why shouldn't we do them? We'll say, well, it says in the Torah, we never accepted it. Of course you accepted it. No, we accepted it. You forced us. When you force someone to accept something, that's not legally binding. So sorry, the giving of the Torah is not legally binding. Now I'm saying this Gemara is fascinating. But by the way, it doesn't get you off the hook because we accepted Purim. So once we accepted Purim, now retrospect, we accept everything else. So now something else is interesting. What it sounds like, and again, maybe what I'm saying is superficial, maybe not. What it sounds like, if God comes back and gives us a present, Me'avat HaNes, Rashi wrote. God comes back, gives us a present. The giving of that present, we accept. And once we accepted that present, so now we can no longer say, hold it, we didn't accept everything else. No, that itself is an indication that the relationship has now been healed. Not just has the relationship been healed, there's love in this relationship. And once there's love in this relationship, then all of those mistakes in the past become ways in order to focus on perhaps what not to do and how to fix those ideas. And therefore, this love in terms of God. Because you know what? I want to say this a little bit clearer. When you do something wrong, there's always two elements to it. One element is the actual thing, and the other element is how does that impact the relationship. So over here, our accepting the Purim holiday by recognizing that God saved us is itself, and as Rashi stressed, you know, we accepted this out of love, that itself heals the relationship. And now what the Gemara is understanding now in retrospect, everything which had gone wrong till now at this point is healed as well and is fixed. This Gemara continues and gives us a couple of other elements, and I just want to line them up, and then we'll come back. But first, maybe one or two things to keep in mind. By the time we finished last week, we had seen this wonderful passage in the Zohar, which is quoted a lot, that Purim and Yom Kippurim have some kind of a commonality to them. To the extent that, in the words of the Zohar, Esther is like the Kohen Gadol, because it's Yom Kippurim. Purim and Yom Kippur have this commonality to them. If I try to think a little bit further, there's almost like an inverse relationship, because Purim is when we celebrate with our bodies, and then Yom Kippur is the day that we don't use our bodies at all in a certain sense. We don't eat, we don't drink, and so on. There's even one rabbinic source, which I did not bring for you, which is in the Pirkei Drabelezer. He says that specifically on Yom Kippur, we try to be as angelic as possible. Some people have a custom of wearing white on Yom Kippur to look angelic. Some people have a custom of standing on Yom Kippur, like standing like angels stand. Some people, again, we have a law not to eat, not to drink. Angels don't eat and don't drink. And that the commonality over here is trying to create an angelic sense. Purim is not angelic. Purim may be many things, but it's not angelic. What Purim is something which is very much body based, and sometimes even debasing, which means what Purim is about is eating and drinking and celebrating and so on. Very, very different from Yom Kippur. On the other hand, there is something ironic, which I don't know how intrinsic it is, but the day before Yom Kippur is a day that we're obligated to eat, and then we fast. The day before Purim is a day that we're obligated to fast, and then we eat. So some people see this as being a very interesting inverse in between the 2 days, and therefore Yom Kippur, it's almost like looking in the mirror, but you're getting a reversed angle on it, and therefore you have to just broaden the scope a little bit. And the day before Yom Kippur and Yom Kippur, the day before Purim and Purim, and then they create this interesting balance or counterbalance between one another. And I hope that makes sense. The reason why I hesitate with that a little bit is that Tanit Esther, which is tomorrow, is actually a very late custom. It's not from the time of the Megillah. It's not from the time of the Mishnah of the Gemara. And I'm pretty sure that if I were giving a halakha class, I can prove that not only was they not accustomed then, it was probably against accepted halakha during that particular time. Nonetheless, what I'm saying is still true in terms of our experience right now. So what we're going to do is note a couple more things of this passage, and then, as I said, we'll see what we could do with this. In the second paragraph, it's Amar of Yeshua ben Levi. It's still in source number 3. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi continues and he talks about the giving of the Torah, and I just want you to look at, without reading anything, I do this sometimes. I'm going to call this intellectual scanning. What I mean by this is just look at the things I bolded, and they may not mean anything to us, but I just want you to notice the elements here. It talks about giving the Torah, right? On every word that God said, Kol dibur dibur sheyatzami b'kadosh baruch hu, there was bosim, there was bisamim, there was shoshanim, there's more. All of those things have to do with spices. And anybody who was here last week will note that within the Purim story, this whole concept of more of spices, the idea of shoshanim sounds a little similar to Shoshan and Shoshanat Yaakov. And there is this whole Purim subtext about the sense of smell and about the Torah, and that links it to Yom Kippur. But over here, we're not talking about Yom Kippur. Over here, we're talking about Matan Torah. So really, what I'm getting at here, and this is why what I'm going to do today is a little complicated, when I make a comparison between two elements, that it's, I'm not going to say it's simple, but you're able to see what the moving parts are. You got piece number one, piece number two, like I just now did, Yom Kippur and Purim. Day before Yom Kippur, the day before Purim. And again, I can look at it. What I'm doing right now is I'm actually bringing in a third moving piece, a third element, and that's why it's going to be a little more complicated. What was our third piece? The third piece is really the way that we started today. The Jews accepted the Torah. So you have over here a Kabbalat Torah. The Kabbalat is now compared to what happened all the way by Sinai. So what happened by Sinai when we theoretically accepted the Torah, there we didn't have a chance. So in a sense now I have three moving parts. If you want my three moving parts, they are the holiday of Shavuot, we're receiving the Torah. We have the holiday of Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement. And we have the holiday of Purim. And again, it's easy for you to say to me, well, this is a Torah law and this is a rabbinic law, but that's part of exactly the issue, is that when the rabbinic law is created, we need some kind of model, right, to model it on, and where are we going with it? So now what we're seeing is that, well, there's something about Purim connected to Yom Kippurim, and there's something about Purim which the Gemara is telling us now to connect it to Chag HaShivuot. And I think now we have the information we need to move on. Now, in this second passage, on the same page or the next page in Gemara Shabbat, that was on Pei Chet Amid Aleph, and now we're already up to Pei Chet Amid Bet. So the next page over, it's talking about receiving the Torah, but all of these elements of the Bisamim, using the nose, the sense of smell, so all of that to me is interesting, without diving deep and understanding exactly what it's saying. That's what I'm saying, it's sort of just like scanning over the ideas and realize that there's something over here which is interesting. The next paragraph, which is still Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, he says, not only was there the sense of smell and so on, but he says, "Kol dibur v'dibur sheyatzami pi'kadosh baruch hu yatzat nishmatan sheYisrael," that they all died by Har Sinai. They died because it was so intense. By the way, this goes back to lifting up the mountain. It's so intense they died, but it says that God then nonetheless brings them back to life. That the receiving of the Torah has within it an element of death and resurrection. It has this element of being reborn. Maybe that's also something which is very interesting. That and rebirth always indicates some type of a change. But over here he's saying is that receive the Torah also had this near-death experience, or if not a death experience. So that's the next point, which is interesting. There's a third point, and by the way, note, this is we've been actually writing Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi now for a while, because he's the one who talked about the sense of smell, and now he's the one who talks about death. And now he adds in another element, I guess we're up to our fourth element. Well, the point was is that a good lawyer can get them off still. A good lawyer can say they accepted this under duress. What it's saying is that this whole point that God used so much leverage on them to receive the Torah itself creates a legal quagmire. And don't necessarily overthink it. You know what's more interesting to me about the actual concept? That someone decided that, let's throw Purim into the story. That's more interesting to me. By the way, if you want to go so far as to say, you know, this whole thing was really about the Purim story. It's talking about duress. It's talking about that. And by the way, how do you know the Purim, that we accepted it? It's very interesting. In the beginning of the story, it says that when Achashverosh are given to drink, it says, everyone according to what they wanted, ain't ones. Nothing against their will. So it's very interesting that the word onus is used. And by the way, Achashverosh was probably guilty of lots and lots and lots of rape along the way. But the drinking was the lo onus. The drinking was the one thing that everybody could decide exactly how to do it. So that itself is interesting. And I completely accept your point. But just listen to what my conclusion is. Because I said it once, I want to say it again. My conclusion is something seems really difficult, but they say, and we start here, and they say this whole thing, I'm not getting it, but they say, oh, this leads over here. What are they really trying to do? They're trying to lead us over here. Which means it's trying more to tell us something about Purim and how Purim is somehow about accepting the Torah than that whole thing in the beginning, that there's something over here which is taking place. Which means maybe I'll go back to my point of exile and having this lack of being centered. You know, Israel just took in a bunch of Ukrainian refugees. We took in a whole bunch. Some of them are Jewish, some of them are not Jewish. Some will end up living here. The ones who end up living here, I can absolutely guarantee you, I don't know if they'll ever convert, not, I can absolutely guarantee you that either them or the children will end up fasting on Yom Kippur. Why? Because it's an Israeli cultural thing. They'll also end up eating cheese on Shavuos. You can say, well, that's not the biggest thing. And end up sitting in a sukkah also. And for that matter, they also may end up fasting on Yom Kippur. Why? Because that's part of the public life of Israel are the holidays. Just like every culture has their holidays, the holidays in Israel are the Jewish holidays. And somebody who ends up living here ends up doing these things. And the reason I'm saying this is because my mother has a first cousin who moved to Israel who their mothers, right, my grandmother's older sister, got married before World War I and ended up getting stuck in near Odessa in Ukraine. And my grandmother and her parents got out and came to America. And she had this older sister who was there. And when they were alive, there was some kind of contact. At some point it stopped and that generation died. And one day we get a phone call from a guy named Igor. And he got out of Russia. He was in France, and he calls he leaves a message on a phone machine by my great uncle, my grandmother's younger brother. I think he was the only one who was alive at the time. And his kids end up contacting him, and they got him into America. They got him his visa because he had family. And this is my mother's first cousin. His mother, my mother's first cousin, ended up coming to Israel. These people were brought up under the communist regime, had no Judaism, no Torah whatsoever. They knew they were Jews, and that was about it. Their family started to fast on Yom Kippur. And we asked them, what happened? They said, no, this is what Israelis do. That's such an interesting thing. This is what Israelis do. They fast on Yom Kippur. This is part of the calendar. So, but what happens on the flip side? What happens when you live in Persia and there's a big party going on? You end up doing the Persia things. Listen, you especially you were all brought up in America. I find it heartbreaking if Jews say, you know, Christmas is such a beautiful time of year and all the lights and all the this and all the that, I find it difficult. And I understand it's more complex. I really do understand that. But I find it as a part of an element of being, of acculturation, of living in another place, which means the Jews who are living in Persia are part of that acculturation. They're experiencing that acculturation, which therefore means I no longer need to keep the Jewish holidays because now I'm a Persian. This is actually the beginning of the story of an exile. So now what happens to Judaism? Does it continue or does it not continue? And by the way, remember it says that either you accept the Torah, or if not, then there will be your deaths. Shum. It says, no, they accepted it there. Which means if they don't accept the Torah, or they don't accept appreciation to God, they don't accept the relationship with God in Persia, so it's over. Which means that's really the point. How many times in our history have we been at the crossroads of saying, either we continue with the Jewish life or we don't? Now, I understand modern man, every single person can make those kinds of decisions themselves. And that wasn't always as simple when we were in our small communities. I don't care right now if it was near Odessa or if it was near Chalab. When we were in our smaller communities, living in a Jewish community, there was a certain sense of community. But what happens when we're spread out, which really sounds to be like this story, we're spread out far and wide. And by the way, that may have been deliberate. Sancheirov most likely deliberately spread people out, because if people are spread out, there's no sense of community. If there's no sense of community, then they lose their identity. If people have a sense of community, then they can bond together. If they bond together, then they can rebel. So one of the ways of stopping rebellion is to displace populations. And over here, that's apparently what happened to the Jews. They're completely spread out, which means what's the next step? The next step is disappearance. And what else? Join the local sensibilities. Which means that's probably so much more of the Purim story than we realize. But nonetheless, and this is one of the great ironies of Jewish history, who brings us together? Haman brings us together. No, you're all Jews. Hitler did the same thing. People who had converted out of Judaism, people who were not practicing, they could not say to Hitler, oh, by the way, I'm not a practicing Jew. You only want the religious ones over there. Didn't help any. He said, no, you got Jewish blood. And he saw this as a full attack on all of them. I know that some of these things sound strange, but over here, the acceptance of Purim is so much more important than I think that we realized, that the rabbis are now telling us, oh, no, this is accepting the Torah. Maybe that gives it a little bit more, makes it a little bit more sense than the way that I said it the first time. The other elements over here is that Matan Torah included also the sense of smell. It included that people felt that they were dying. But then we get to this other paragraph, and this is still on page 2. It's the middle of the page. But Amar Vishu ben Levi, when Moshe went up, the angel started to complain to God. God, you're giving the Torah to a human being? Amar Malchi Asherei Lefanei Kadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shelam, Mali Yulud Isha Beinenu. You know, why are you giving this to somebody who's of flesh and blood? What does somebody who's of flesh and blood need to, need the Torah, or is deserving of the Torah, or is appropriate to receive the Torah? And they say, Chemda Gnuza Lach, you've had this buried treasure, as it were, Shama Utvashivim Ba'arba Darod Kod Mishinavar Olam, which has been hidden for 974 generations before the world was even created. Tama Vakesh Latain Labasar Vadam, you're going to give the Torah to flesh and blood, which means the Torah is ethereal, the Torah is holy, the Torah is spiritual. Why are you giving it to human beings? The next paragraph, Omalokadish Baruch Lamosha, Hechzir Lem Tshuva. Okay, answer them. And Moshe goes on to say, I'm terrified. These are angels. I don't know what they can do to me. And God says, hold on to the Kisei HaKavod. Hold on to my throne and answer them. Hechzir lam tshuva. Ama lefanav ribono shalom. Mityarei ani. Shema yisrafuni behevel shebepihim. Amar lo echoz bikisei kvodi v'chazor lam tshuva. Hold on to the throne. Amar lefanav ribono shalom. What does it say in the Torah? So God says, I'm God who took you out of the land of Egypt. Moshe says, were you guys in Egypt? Were you slaves in Egypt? What do you need the Torah for? And then he says, what else does it say? Don't have any other gods. And it says, you guys hang out with idolaters? Like, what are you talking about? Remember the Sabbath day. You guys do work that you need a day off? He goes, don't take God's name in vain. Same kind of thing. You guys do business that you're going to end up swearing? He goes, honor your father and mother, your fathers and mothers. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. So he says, you have jealousy among you. You have a yetzer hara among you. You have an evil inclination among you. And at that point, they admitted that the Torah is not for them. And it says, and they gave him presents. And by the way, along the way, it says that he even gives them, according to this, the Malach HaMavet gave, the angel of death gave Moshe a present, which is called the Ketoret, which is called the incense. And he says, and this could be used in order to solve the problems of death. Okay, I know that there was a lot there, but I at least want to focus on one thing. To be deserving of Torah, you need to be human. To be deserving of Torah, you need to be frail. To be deserving of Torah, you need to be someone who gives in to temptation. By the way, do you all realize that you all are very, very deserving of Torah? But no, but do you understand what I'm saying? The Torah is not meant for angels. The Torah is meant for human beings. Let me tell you a little bit of a subtext to this. When we leave Pesach, the Yetzirah is compared to Chametz. Right? You ever heard that? Chametz is like the Yetzirah. I have a very simple question. Why is Chametz ever allowed? It should never be allowed. It's Yetzirah. So when we leave Egypt on Pesach, we can't have any Chametz. And then what do we afterwards? We end up meeting then the man. When we get to the holiday of Shavuot, we start using what's called the Shtei HaLechem. How can we serve God in the Beit HaMikdash with lechem, with bread, Yetzirah? Because having a Yetzirah was the clinching argument which allowed God to give us the Torah in the first place. Should I say that again? The fact that we have a Yetzirah is the clinching argument that God gave us the Torah in the first place, because not having Yetzer Hara, so the angels should have held on to it. It is our humanity, it is our frailty, which makes us deserving of receiving the Torah. I mean, see, that's why this Gemara, that's why this Gemara is so interesting, which means that if somebody would say, oh, on the holiday of Shavuot, you should eat. You say, no, it's spiritual, receive the Torah. No, you should eat and you should drink on the holiday of Shavuot. And by the way, that's one of the things, is Shavuot is kulo lachem. It's a holiday for us. In what sense is a holiday for us? To enjoy the pleasure. Why? Because if we didn't have a Yetzer Hara, we would be undeserving of receiving the Torah in the first place. Did that make sense? Because, again, holiday Shavuot, the point is that you bring what's called the Shtei Halechem, you bring the Shtei Halechem on Shavuot. It's like the only time that there's a korban which is brought with bread. This is about Matan Torah. Matan Torah is given on Shavuot. So this is the clinching argument to receive the Torah. So the Torah is all about the Yetzer Hara. If we didn't have the Yetzer Hara, then we'd have nothing to talk about. By the way, I would then say that when the Jews sin with the golden calf, Moshe would say, ah, you see, they need the Torah. Which means, this is proof. Which means the very sins should serve as proof that we need Torah. Right, but the point that creates our claim to Torah, or invalidates the angel's claim, is the very fact that we're human. And we're frail and we make mistakes. I think what they're really saying to understand this passage, they're saying, look at humans, they're so messed up. How can you give them something holy? And God's response is, no, that's what. Meaning the fact that they're really not saying they want it themselves, but that's ends up being implied. You know, we're not on a high enough level. So Moshe says to them, God says to Moshe, answer them. And Moshe's response is, no, it's because of all the frailty that you think within us, which is why ultimately we need it. What I want to add to this thought now is one more point. We mess up with the golden calf. We eat and we drink and we party big time. And then God threatens to destroy us and we get forgiven. On what day do we get forgiven? On Yom Kippur. Now, Yom Kippur is very interesting. Because in Yom Kippur, we don't eat, we don't drink, right? We don't do anything which is physical, this is what I mentioned before. But Yom Kippur and Shavuot do have a commonality to them. What is the common point between the two of them? That we receive the Ten Commandments on Shavuot. By the way, we won't receive them physically then. That's when God says the Ten Commandments. When Moshe goes up and then comes down 40 days later, it's the 17th day of Tammuz, and then he breaks the Luchot, because the people are sinning with the golden calf. We get to Yom Kippur, that's when the Jews are forgiven, and God gives Moshe the new Luchot, the second Luchot. So therefore, I would even go so far as to say that God gave us the Torah. What do we call Matan Torah? Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. But is it Kabbalat HaTorah? So that's exactly was the point of the first Gemara we saw. The Kabbalat HaTorah was deficient. Receiving the Torah was deficient. God gives it, but we just weren't receiving it. When did we perhaps receive the Torah? On Yom Kippur we receive the Torah. Which means Yom Kippur is when we get the second Luchot. Yom Kippur is a day of receiving the Torah. Which means there's 2 days of receiving the Torah. One is a day which our physicality is the clinching argument to receive it. And the other is to keep us alive, our physicality is completely pushed away. Is what I just now said clear in any way? The holiday of Shavuot and the holiday of Yom Kippur seem to be very different, even though they have something in common. What's the point in common? One, we receive the Ten Commandments, and the other, we receive the Ten Commandments. By the way, there's these other Ten Commandments which are broken, which are interesting as well. The fact that God then says, take the broken Ten Commandments and put them right next to the real Ten Commandments also tells us something. That even if we mess up and even if we break things and so on, there's still something there which is redeemable. And God knows that human beings sometimes are broken Ten Commandments, but he puts them right next to the real ones. And that itself is an incredible, incredible statement. So now, I want to try again. We receive the Torah. When? We receive the Torah on the holiday Shavuot. And that talks about the physicality. We receive the Torah again on the holiday of Yom Kippur. But there's something about Yom Kippur which is the antithesis to the physical. It's all about the spiritual. And then we receive the Torah again, which was the very point of that source that we saw in the beginning, is that we receive the Torah again on Purim. And now let's admit it, Purim is like this totally physical day, which some of us may say, therefore, that, you know, how could a frivolous day like Purim anyway be connected with receiving the Torah? I think I may have, you know, underneath the surface of everything I've just now said, really made an argument about exactly why Purim is a day of receiving the Torah, because it's a day of such physicality. With all this in mind, you're now going to understand the Gemara, which I think most people who read it don't get. Say, like, what is it talking about? But first, we'll read a Kabbalistic source, the Chesed LaAvraham. It's in source number 6. Rabbi Avraham Azulai, he was the great-grandfather of the Chida. He was a student of Rav Chaim Vital, and he writes as follows. And he says it very simply without all of the Kabbalistic stuff, but we're going to have to, again, unpack this a little bit. And by the way, one of the reasons we're reading this, just very, 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 very immodestly, is I figured this out by myself, but I was just looking for a dead rabbi to say it, because you guys don't trust me. You trust dead rabbis more than you trust me. Correct? Correct. V'yesh mehem yamim shehu mitzvah le'echol behem basar v'lishdot yayin. There are days where there is an obligation to eat and to drink. So before we read the next couple of lines, what day is there an obligation to eat and to drink? Ah, very good. V'yesh mem yamim shemulvad shemitzvah lechol basar l'shtot yayin him chova alav. The absolute obligation. What days are they? V'hem yom shavuot, the holiday of Shavuot, v'erev yom ha-kippurim, the day before Yom Kippur. Now that's interesting because we just now moved it one drop from Yom Kippur to the day before Yom Kippur. V'yom Purim, and the day of Purim. Elu shlosha him chova gemura mutal al adam l'smoach b'hem b'chilat basar v'shtei yayin. These are 3 days that were totally involved in the physical world to eat and to drink, eat meat, drink wine. U'l'smoach b'hem yoter midai u'l'harbot b'hem basar v'yayin. And really to be absolutely, totally enraptured with joy on these days. And that itself is really interesting that it took those 2 days. Now, first of all, you notice the great subtlety what he just now did. Because I brought together Shavuot, Yom Kippurim, and Purim, but Yom Kippurim was an outlier. Why? Because we fast on that day. There is no eating, there is no drinking on that day. Now, where did he get this from? First of all, you can use logic to get to this point. But here's the Gemara, source number 7. Tan v'lezer omer, ein lo ladam b'yom tov, ela o ochel v'shoteh, o yoshev v'shoneh. What's a holiday about? You eat and you drink, or you should be involved in spirituality, you're studying. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Chalkol, Chetzer v'lechilal shtia, v'chetzio lebeit midrash. Divided half and half. Half the day should be spent eating and drinking, and half the day should be spent in spiritual pursuits. V'amar Rav Yochanan, u'shnei mikra echa darshu. And they both were looking at the same verse. K'tuv echad omer, atzeret l'hashem elokecha. Atzeret is the holiday of Shavuot. It's for God. Atzeret l'hashem elokecha. V'katuv echad omer, atzeret tia lachem. It says, atzeret is for you. Rabbi Lezer Savar, okulu l'hashem, okulu lachem. Well, it's either completely for you or completely for God. Rabbi Yeshua Savar, chelkehu, chatzi l'hashem v'chatzi lachem. Amr Belazer, Hakol Modim, Batseret, Bainanami Lachem. Everybody agrees that Shavuot has to have a physical element as well. My time, and what's the reason? Yom Shenit Nobot Torahu, the day the Torah was given. Now, you all know a deeper reason for this now. What's the deeper reason? If we didn't have the physical side to us, we would be undeserving of Torah. It was the clinching argument to receive the Torah. So it says, no, everybody agrees on the Halei Shavuot, it has to have a physical side to it. It's the day we receive the Torah. So again, I just now tied this in with the other Gemara that we saw in Shabbat. Amar Rabba, Hakol Modim b'Shabbat b'Inan, will skip. Amar Rav Yosef, Hakol Modim b'Purim, Dinami b'Inan Nami Lachem. Everyone would give Purim also, which means what we're doing now in the Gemara is it's running now a connection between Atzeret and Purim. And it says, my time, how do you know that? It says, Yimei Mishteh v'Simcha. These were days of drinking and of happiness. Mar B'Rei D'Ravina, Kulu Shata v'Yotiv b'Tanita. There was a rabbi who, oh, I don't know if he's a rabbi, by the way. It's called Mar Brei D'Ravina. His name is Mar Brei D'Ravina. He would always fast. Kula shata havayotiv betanita. The guy fasted all year round, except for 3 days. Levar me atzarta, on the holiday Shavuot, ubipurya, and on Purim, umale yom de kippuri, on erev yom kippur. So what we saw in the Chesed Avraham, when he picked out these 3 days, in a certain sense, what he's doing is he's looking over here. Atzeret Yom Shenitna Bo Torah. Right? That's the day Torah is given. Puria Yimei Mishteh. Malad Yom Kippurim, because whoever eats on Erev Yom Kippur is a fast in Yom Kippur. Now, what I want to try to do is to show that these three points are actually, I think, a little bit more connected than we would have realized. So, in order to do this properly, let's start all over again, and I want you to understand not just the words I'm saying, but the methodology of what we're doing this. Purim has a certain way of celebrating. Simple question is why? Which means if I were to say to you, we eat and drink on Purim, I think you would all get that. But there are a couple of other elements. We read over the story. I think we get that as well. What's not clear to me about Purim, at least as of this moment, would be why do we give Mishloach Manot, Ish L'Re'ehu? Why are we giving out gifts? And the other point is, why are we giving Matanat Levyonim? Why are we taking care of the poor on this particular day? And I think that there's a common idea behind them. But of course, what I want to do to make this a little bit more interesting is to try to put this together with our larger focus, which is on these other days. In source number 9, and by the way, here you have Nahafochu, the Rama writes before the Machaber. It's always the Machaber before the Rama. Over here for Purim, of course, it's Nahafochu. The Rama writes, Mitzvah Harbot Besudat Purim. There's an obligation of going over the top with a Purim Suda. The Machaber then writes, Sudat Purim, Shasa B'layla Lo Yatzad Erechavto. It's not at night, but rather you should party a little at night, but the main is in the morning. Halacha Bet writes, Chayav V'nishlav of Sumi B'Puria. You should also drink on Purim. Maybe that's also something we need to focus on a little bit. And a whole big comment about how you drink, how much you drink, and so on. Then in Halacha Dalid, we're still talking about the obligation of the meal. Chayav L'shloach L'chaveh, Shnei Manot Basar, O Shnei Minei Ochalim. Shnei Ma'am L'shloach Manot, Ish L'Re'ehu. That there is an obligation of sending. By the way, I know that people think it's two different brachot. No, you can give two pieces of meat if you want to, right? You want to send over two steaks, you can send over two steaks. It's one big steak, no, but two steaks you can send over. Says over here, shtei manot. If you want, you can send over one steak and one corned beef. That also works. No, I'm saying it very clearly. What's the or two bottles of wine? Two bottles of wine work as well, because it's mashloach manot ish l're'ehu. So it's two types of things. And then he says, but the more people you send to, the better, which is also a very interesting thing, and that's part of what we need to figure this out. The halacha beforehand, source 10, was that everyone's obligated to give two gifts to two poor people. That means one gift to each person. You need to give to poor people as well. And not only that, whoever opens up their hand and asks for things, you give it to them. Good. Source number 11, I also figured out by myself. And again, looking for a dead rabbi. But this is a suspicious dead rabbi. This is called the Chemdat Yamim. It's published in 1731. And he quotes from the Olot Ephraim, who's a bit older, from 1619. The reason why it's suspect is because some people think that he has some Sabbatean ideas inside the book that he may have thrown in haphazardly. But he noticed part of what we've already been pointing out, and that these 3 days, the commonality between Shavuot and Yom Kippurim and Purim, is that these are 3 days of accepting the Torah. Okay? So he actually says a lot of this, and some of this is from the Olalot Ephraim, who is the author of the Kli Akar, if that will help us. It's a book where he writes about holidays. Now, the verse I cited before, that Vashtia Kedat Ein Ones, there was no forcing by the drinking, that's number 2. Okay. Now, there's another thing which is in common with these 3 holidays, where, again, what am I trying to do? I told you, I want to be very clear. If the laws of Purim include giving Mishloach Manot and giving Matanot of Yonim, giving gifts to the poor, giving to friends, the more friends that you give to, the better. If that's one of the laws of Purim, then there must be some reason behind it. And I would go further. I would use semi-Kabbalistic language and say that there must be some kind of a tikkun over here, some kind of a fixing that takes place, that something was broken which is being fixed. So on Friday night, one of the songs that we sing is Lecha Dodi. The author of the Lecha Dodi, his name was, well, he actually writes his name in the thing, it was Shlomo Halevi, right? Which is why he writes What does he write? Shamor v'zachor b'dibur achad. In the rabbinic text he's quoting was Zachor v'shamor b'dibur achad. Why did he switch the order? Because his name was Shlomo, not Zalman. If his name was Zalman, then it would be Zachor v'shamor b'dibur achad. But he switched, or Zvulun. He switches the order, but that's Shlomo Halevi Alkabitz. He puts his name in the thing. He was a colleague of the Arizal. Of Yosef Karo. He's in Tzfat during that time. So he also wrote a book. He was a Kabbalist. He also wrote a book which is called Manot Levi. Maybe, but he's been dead for 400 years.
Are there something like that now?
Yes, I knew you were going to say that. Anyway, the Rav Shlomo Levi Alkovitz wrote a book on Megillat Esther called Manot Levi. And he says that the purpose of Mishloach Manot is because Haman, when he points at us, were people divided. By the way, I'll say it again. Why are we divided? It could very well be because that's what they did to us. They divided up the population. He said, these are people divided. They're dangerous people. So he said that why is it important to divide them out? Because then there's no sense of community, and therefore there's less of a chance of rebellion. So when you conquer a people, you move them out of their land, so there's no sense of dividing their land, and then you divide them up, so there's no sense of community, and that would have been the strategy. So Haman points, oh, look at this divided people, and that's one of the problems. So therefore, if we are a divided people, the way to fix being a divided people is to bring us together. If you look at source 19, it's almost the first thing that Esther says to Mordechai, Lech knoset kol ha-yudim, gather the people together. That was for prayer. Later on, Vayikahalu Yahayud, source number 20, Vayikahalu Yahudim Hashem B'Shushan, right? They gather together. Nikahalu, they congregate, literally. And that's where we get these points of Yom Mishta V'Simcha and so on, and Simcha Mishta V'Yom Tov Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reyehu. So what Manot Halevi said is the reason that we have on Purim, Mishloach Manot and Matanot Yovnim, is in order to create a sense of community. If the weakness or the Achilles point was that we're people divided, the way to solve that is to become a people who are unified. And the way that we're unified is to do what I'll call almost, it's not quite, but almost, random acts of kindness. By the way, that's probably the most important thing you can do in a marriage. Completely random acts of kindness. Not just because that's what you do. You make your wife coffee in the morning. We have to talk more about the coffee. But you do random acts of kindness for somebody. You buy gifts even though it's not their birthday. You do things meaning that's what makes a relationship strong, is both sides just care about the other and they do things for other. That creates a sense of love and compassion. And part of what needed to be done in Purim, apparently, is that we need to send these acts. And by the way, maybe you specifically send the Mishloach Manot to the person who's not your best friend. Maybe specifically the person who's there. Okay, let's have a beer together. That's really part of what Purim is. Again, he held a beer barrel on us, which was part of the problem. Part of the tikkun is that we need to somehow to go about fixing this, and that I think is interesting. Now, this we'll note is actually part of the commonality with those other two dates. One of the things we learned, and I think we've heard this lots of times, source number 13, it says that when they arrive at Mount Sinai, there's something unique happens. It says all the other times in plural, Vayisu'u merifidim, in plural they traveled, Vayivu'u, in plural they got to the Midbar Sinai, Vayichanu, in plural they encamped by Midbar, Vayichan sham Yisrael neged ahar. When it came to near the mountain, then it says it in the singular. Rashi writes, Vayichan sham Yisrael ki ish achad b'lev achad. They were completely unified. Avakal shar kol achaniyot b'tar umot of machloket. Generally, the Jews fight with one another. We don't get along with one another. But that was one moment. Har Sinai was a moment of unity, which therefore means to receive the Torah, there needs to be unity. So now if I go back and I try to look, the connection between Chag Shavuot, receiving the Torah, and Purim, when we re-receive the Torah, so it makes a lot of sense that we try to get back to that point of unity between the two. But I told you, I have three points that I wanted to cover today. And the third point is Yom Kippur, or now we realize even better, Erev Yom Kippur. So is there a sense of unity on Erev Yom Kippur? And of course the answer is going to be yes. Where do we see that? If you look at source number 17, the Shulchan Aruch writes that Averot Sheben, this is based on the Mishnah, Averot Sheben Adam L'Chaveiro Ein Yom Kippur mechaper ad shivaisenu. That Yom Kippur doesn't help sins between man and their fellow man. And it goes into some more details. And it says, therefore, what do people do? And it's specifically on Erev Yom Kippur, what do? We go around and we ask one another for forgiveness. There's actually a couple of Gemarot over here in Source 18 that we find people absolutely behaving like that, which therefore is Erev Yom Kippur. I just want to say everything now a little bit sharper. Erev Yom Kippur is the day that we go about to one another and we ask for forgiveness. Why? In order to create a sense of unity. I'll go a little bit further. It's not a technical thing. Oh, I'm not going to be forgiven on Yom Kippur unless I ask this guy for forgiveness. I think it's much more than that. You know what? We even ask people for forgiveness that we didn't do anything for. Right? We call them up and we say, oh, I hope you mocha me for anything I may have done. But I didn't do anything. Why should he ask? I think the reason is that when we want to get to Yom Kippur, we want to do this unified as Am Yisrael together. It's that the forgiveness of Yom Kippur is about a unified people. The Seir Mishtaleach is something for all of Am Yisrael, and we want to create unity, which means Erev Yom Kippur is a day of unity. Arriving at Mount Sinai is a day of unity. Purim is a day of unity, which means these days have this in common, not just receiving the Torah, or maybe that's the flip side of receiving the Torah. The Torah is not given to me as an individual. The Torah is given to Klal Yisrael. If I want the Torah, I need to feel a sense of being part of Klal Yisrael. The day before Yom Kippur is a day that we eat and we drink and we celebrate. It's a day that we ask for forgiveness. It's a day, maybe even one step further, maybe the day before Yom Kippur is the day I accept the Torah, and then I can enter into Yom Kippur and ask for forgiveness as well. Maybe, again, there's this element of receiving the Torah in Yom Kippur. Maybe that's the way that I enter into Yom Kippur. I've received the Torah. I accept upon myself the Torah. I accept upon myself the mitzvot. And now I ask God for forgiveness. Maybe that's exactly the point of what's emerging out of all of this. But I want to get to one more point. One of the things we saw from Yeshuv and Levi is that the Jews had a near-death experience when it came to receiving the Torah. At Har Sinai, there was a near-death experience, and he had to bring us back to life. It was too intense. Yom Kippur is also a near-death experience. Yom Kippur is a near-death experience because maybe we did something wrong, and maybe we're, you know, at the brink of death spiritually, or God's going to give us a decree, and hopefully we can get that canceled. Which means this bringing back to life, this element of having a second chance, is very much what the element of Yom Kippur is and has in common with the holiday of Shavuot. Purim also is, maybe that's the easiest part of Purim for me to have explained from the beginning. We're in a near-death experience, and somehow the miraculous takes place, and we end up getting saved. Which means it's this coming from death to life, which is interesting. And maybe in this context, we'll get to our last two sources for today. Source number 21 is this remarkable story which may destroy all drinking on Purim. Right after we're told that Who of course is going to be the one to tell us that we need to drink on Purim? Rava. Amar Rava, source 21. Mechayev inish l'fsumi b'purya. We're obligated to drink on Purim. Ad lo yada ben baruch Mordechai l'ar Haman. Until you know the difference between that Mordechai should be blessed and Haman should be cursed. Rabba v'Reb Zera, of the Suda Purim b'hadi adadi. They had Purim together. Vata de ipsum, when they got completely trashed, kam Rava v'shachti de Reb Zera. Rava stood up, or Rabba, there's two different gears, by the way. Maybe Rava stood up and killed Reb Zera. Slaughtered him, shechted him. Lamacher, the next day, boy Rachme, he prayed. Alev Achye, he came back to life. Lashana, the next year, Amrle said, Leiti Marv Navitsu de Purim Badadadi, let's do it again, let's do Purim together. Amrle, love Kol Shat Vashat Mitcharish Nisa. Not on every single day do miracles take place. By the way, but when people get up and kill one another, by the way, everyone always assumes it's Rabba who invites Reb Zera the next year. Maybe it was Reb Zera who invited Rabba the next year. It says, come, let's do this again. And Rabba say, no, miracles don't, I don't know if I can bring you back. Let me say a couple of more things. One, I have a whole chapter in my book on Agadot about Reb Zera. You should read the whole chapter. But one interesting thing about Reb Zera is that we're told that there were hoodlums, punks, any other better word for this?
Goons
in his neighborhood. And everyone else was frightened of them. And he was friendly with them. He would smile, good morning, guys, how you doing? And these ruffians, that's a good word, ruffians. And he was chill with them completely. Everybody else was frightened of them. And he And when Reb Zeira died, they said, oh my God, till now we had Reb Zeira, who was our pal, and he would pray, and he would pray for us, and you know, we were short of spiritual success. But now that Reb Zeira is dead, we're going to have to now pray for ourselves. So it's very interesting, just in terms of that background. Maybe Reb Zeira was such a tzaddik, he asked about holy people. Reb Zeira was such a tzaddik. Maybe that's part of what Rab is doing. Listen, as long as you're alive, Am Yisrael's not going to get to where they need to get to. I got to kill you in order. But then, why does he bring them back? So I don't know what to do with this. But I will say, there's something interesting about Rab and Reb Zeira. What does the word Rabba mean? It means big. What does Zeira mean? It means small. So you have somebody who's very big killing somebody who's very small, which is also very interesting. But maybe Rabba in this story then metaphorically represents the nations of the world who threaten us, and Reb Zeira is this little vulnerable Jew, and he's the real Jew, he's the real thing, and he gets killed on Purim. But what happens? He comes back to life. Rav Huttner in source number, I didn't give a number to it, so it's 21 and a half. That's the final source for today. He writes, everybody knows what happened in the story of Rabban Reb Zeira. Ma nase besuda purim etzel chazal anu yodim kam rabba v'shachter Reb Zeira. We know that rabba get up and killed Reb Zeira. V'nei pirushol shigmar zu b'shar yimot shana inu nugei elenu hayom. He's speaking on Yom Kippur, on Purim, when he writes, when this is being, you know, written, transcribed, and so on. He says, the way I would explain it all year round is one thing, but the way we learn on Purim is something else. This is how we understand this on Purim. B'shad shmiat aseret ha-dibrot parcha nishmatan shiusola kol dibor v'dibor. All the Jews died receiving the Torah. Ad shirid ha-kodesh baruch hu tal shel tchia, till God brought them back to life. V'muchuvan b'zehi, ki lam zeu klal b'kalbat ha-Torah, that when you receive the Torah, u'klitata l'toch atzmiut ha-nefesh, and it gets absorbed within the essence of the soul, she'en hi ba elamito chidush ha-chiyut asher ba-adam. Receiving the Torah creates a transformation where we become new individuals completely. Klomar, ha-nefesh ha-mekabel ha-divrei ha-Torah tzrich liot chiyut chadasha haba b'mkoma shel ha-chiyut ha-kodemet. That whoever we were before we received the Torah becomes somebody else completely after we receive the Torah. And therefore, he says, with every word of the Seret HaDibrot, we get transformed, we become new. And instead, they became something new. But regarding the receiving of Torah at Sinai, there was a protest. It was under duress. But we accepted the Torah anew during the time of Achashverosh. Therefore, when we got at the end of the Purim story with Achashverosh, we became someone new by accepting the Torah. He goes, and therefore, Rabba got up and killed Reb Zeira. We don't get up to such levels, right? Because we can't bring people back to life. Nonetheless, we need to undergo a transformation in terms of our intellect and have something change dramatically. And we're going to spend the day trying to make something new come alive again in terms of our understanding. And we're going to try to become reborn in terms of getting to a new level. And therefore we need to drink on Purim until we become new people. So he says that's part of, and I just want to now tie in all three. Shavuot, we came back to life because we needed to become a new person because now we're people of Torah. Yom Kippur is also about rebirth. All of the sins that we had, the sins die, but now we come back to life and we become new people. Purim, he's saying, therefore, is also this point of this connection. So what is it that I try to do today? What I try to do today is actually show that the element of accepting the Torah on Purim and the physicality on Purim and the giving presents on Purim and all of the elements of Purim actually connect to this larger matrix, as it were, which pull together Matan Torah, Har Sinai, and Yom Kippurim, which themselves were connected, but now we have like kind of this triangle, and all of them have this commonality of receiving the Torah, but all of them have this commonality where we need commonality, and therefore we need the sense of brotherhood, and therefore Yom Kippur, Erev Yom Kippur, we ask for forgiveness, and on Shavuot we end up, we are one people, and therefore how do we do this on Purim? We end up giving gifts to those who are in need, which means these are all emanating from a common point and a common source. But ultimately, what they're really all about is transformation. That's what they're really all about. And maybe it's easier to see the transformation on Yom Kippur, and maybe it's easier to see the transformation on receiving the Torah, but Purim is also about a transformation. But the challenge of the transformation on Purim, and this is part of what Rav Huttner was alluding to over here, that it's not easy. It's not easy to, you know what? Yom Kippur is an easier day to serve God, but it's a spiritual cop-out. Sorry for saying that. Why is it a spiritual cop-out? Okay, I'll be like an angel today. Okay, one day I'll be like an angel. So it's one thing to serve God. I'm not going to eat. I'm not going to drink. So I kept kosher that day. I didn't get drunk that day. I didn't do anything wrong that day. Why? Because it's Yom Kippur. But do you understand why I'm calling that a spiritual cop-out? To keep Purim properly and have a transformative Purim, that's a whole nother level. On Purim, we get to this point of loving God, of revealing the love of God because of the miracle. By the way, again, what was the secret of loving God? When you love God and you do tshuva out of love of God, then all the mistakes that you made end up becoming mitzvah. By the way, if anybody possibly drank all year, and then on Purim you say that I am now relating to God out of everything that I've done, suddenly, retroactively, all of your drinking becomes a preparation for Purim celebration. Every single mistake gets elevated on Purim, which means it's not just Yom Kippur, because really, let's face it, Yom Kippur is a time that you really serve God out of fear. Purim is a time that you serve God out of love. You're serving God out of fear, and that's part of also that fear of the mountain over your head. But on the other hand, you get to Purim, it's serving God out of love and serving God out of happiness. There is so much more potential involved in this. And ultimately, as you're eating and as you're drinking and as you're involved in this physical world, you look to God and say, this is why I needed the Torah. This is the clinching argument. This is why Moshe was able to bring the Torah down from heaven, which means ultimately God, you know, try to give us, and maybe there's a protest, maybe it was too much. But now think about it. When we received the Torah, there was this overwhelming sense of prophecy, of godliness, of God is with us, and therefore we're forced. But what happens on Purim? We don't see God in the story. God isn't there. We still accept the Torah with no pressure whatsoever, which means we could have walked away. But accepting the Torah when there's no pressure, that's a whole nother ballgame. Which means, look, ultimately, what does it mean to grow up? What's Naaseh V'Nishma? Naaseh V'Nishma means Naaseh, I'm going to do, V'Nishma, I'm going to keep on listening. I'm going to keep on listening even when God is no longer talking. Which means the very idea that they made up a holiday, Midrabanan, they said, this is what God would have told us to do if God was still talking to us. There's something unbelievable about that. When we started it, they accepted the Purim holiday and say, what would God have said if God was still talking? Which means ultimately, when you grow up, sorry for saying like this, because, and to a great extent right now, you get yourself into situations and sometimes you say, okay, what would my mother tell me if she was standing here? What would my father say? What would my grandmother say? What would my rabbi say? Which means when I'm able to internalize what other people do, by the way, in terms of learning, when you're able now to learn by yourselves one day and say, what would my teacher have asked over here? And how would he have thought of an answer? When you could do that by yourself, at that point you're independent. And that's the goal. That's the goal, which means Purim is when the Jews became independent because God stopped talking. Now what's going to happen? Are we going to fall down? Will our deaths be over there? Or will we be able to get up and stand up and figure out how to be a people? The fact that we were able to create a rabbinic holiday is itself something which is really quite miraculous, and that's part of what the celebration is. Which means Purim is this remarkable holiday which has so many different elements. And what I was trying to do today is to identify the elements. The methodology I used was looking at various Gemarot. The other methodology I used was looking at the practices. If these are the things that we do on that day, then those have to have significance in terms of the celebration of that day and the fixing of our neshamot which need to take place. So the conclusion is, you got to drink on Purim, you have to celebrate with happiness, you have to celebrate with joy, you accept the Torah anew, and you undergo this transformation, but you don't have to go as far as Rabbah and Reb Zera.